Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. And she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This August 1st, 2017 edition, episode 108 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from London, Ontario, Canada, as well as Guy from Athens, Greece. I'm Corey Morningstar, your co-host for Nature Bats Last on PRN, and I'm calling in live from CHRW Radio from Western. Special thanks to Adam, my tech guy here. Thank you very much, Adam. We're taking your calls on today's show. For us and for our guest, please give our guest a little time to articulate his work, and then please call us with your toll-free comments and questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Guy, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Corey Morningstar, and thanks to Adam and our own tech guys at the PRN studio. I'm in Athens, Greece, relatively recently completed a tour of the Midwestern United States. From that tour comes a blurb about a feature movie project, The Cultural Amnesiac. It's from Raman Gopalan, who I met on the tour. He hosted me, and he drove me for 8.5 hours, 4 hours one day, stayed at his house, 4.5 hours the next day. I'm going to give a little blurb from his featured movie project, The Cultural Amnesiac. What if you did everything right? You went to school and aced every test, landed in the gifted program, wrote articles for the newspaper at the age of 7, won at science fairs and climbing competitions alike, even helped at the soup kitchen and the library. You went to an Ivy League school and then got recruited to make an Ivy League income. What if you were well-recognized for your acumen at work and you had the drive and wherewithal to do and own all the things you liked? And then something happens and you can't look at things like you did anymore. This is the story of our protagonist, Laura. Her journey from entrenched in building her life as a successful engineer with modern values to being no longer able to understand or believe school as a place of learning, to believe family as mother, father, and children, to believe cars and homes as measures of success, to evaluate sustained growth as tenable, to evaluate money as equivalent with wealth. The Cultural Amnesiac is a deeply personal story. Raman started out, like everyone else, indoctrinated with virtues of discipline, rules, goals, and expectations. He worked hard to deliver on those values. None of them felt quite right, but he keeps at it, feeling misplaced. Thinking apart from the crowd is a difficult thing to do, of course, since we humans are molded by peer pressure and family. It's taken years to see things differently, to understand what daycare and schools are, what nuclear families have lost, how the singular pursuit of monetary wealth has become all-consuming because we don't think past what we've been told. Laura, the protagonist, who's forgotten her conditioning and habits due to a bonk on the head, has no choice but to see the world differently. Raman says he's hoping that folks will take the journey with her and dare to question the way they live. So I saw a little bit of what was going on in Raman's head with his previous short film, Zebras. That's what he calls his parvum opus. This film, The Cultural Amnesiac, will be his magnus opus. It looks to me like it will be quite the piece of social commentary. I look forward to seeing it when it comes out.
So, Corey, Guy, Guy, I just want to ask you, when do you expect that to be out? Do you have any idea?
Well, I don't
Time
really
frame?
know. He's still in pre-production, so it could be a year. It could
Okay.
be a year we don't have. It's really hard to say with this kind of project.
It sounds like a great project. I mean, I continue to, struggle with all those things that you just mentioned. I'm sure our viewers can identify, and obviously you as well.
Well, of course. I mean, we hear the same story and think it should be applied to everybody in much the same way. And, when thinking outside the box is going to one fast food restaurant instead of the other that your friends go to, I mean, that's the culture we're born into and that we have become so inextricably part of. And so I like the idea for this film, which is to have somebody suffer a brain disease who's really at the peak of their life, the peak of their young life. So everything's going Laura's way. And then she gets a bonk on the head and she realizes she can no longer see things the same way. And so she starts asking these questions about the culture that make her appear naive to everybody else. And she is naive. She just doesn't even know it. So, she's asking these hard questions that almost nobody asks. And so it's a nice format. It reminds me of Oliver Sacks, the famous neuroscientist and writer who people would come to when anybody had any sort of brain disease or dysfunction of their brain. And, she would be a perfect case for Oliver Sacks because her brain is making her think differently than anybody else, which, of course, you and I think is pretty exciting, but Laura apparently has some difficulty with it.
Very cool. Guy, do you know if we have Michael Swift on the line?
Michael Swift, are you there?
Good morning.
Oh my
There
God.
he is.
Success.
Woo!
Very exciting.
Corey, will you introduce Michael to our listener?
Sure. I dug this out of the trash bin from last month so I can basically say it all over again. Okay. Michael Swift is a volunteer activist and advocate residing in Brisbane, capital of the coal, gas, and beef state, known as Queensland, Australia. He is part of the Critical Thinking Collective, Wrong Kind of Green, and a self-described messaging obsessive. His work focuses on the nonprofit industrial complex, with a special interest in the development of the Galilee Basin coal complex, networked hegemony, the collateralization of nature for the quote-unquote new economy, and in highlighting the political will for fossil fuel-driven industrial decarbonization. You can find Michael's work, his writing on his blog, We Suspect Silence, also Wrong Kind of Green, and on his Twitter handle at Empathizer. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What
Good
time is it
morning.
there?
It's about 10 past 5 in the morning.
Wow. And have you had coffee?
Yes.
Alcohol?
And it's tomorrow there. It's almost tomorrow here in Athens, Greece, but it's nowhere close to tomorrow in Ontario, Canada. So we have quite the conversation going in three countries. I should point out for those of us who speak a different brand of English from those of you in Canada and Australia, that at Empathizer, Michael's Twitter handle is spelled with an S, not a
Ah,
Z, or
you
what you might call
professor, you are just too much of a professor. Okay,
a
I'm cutting you
Thank
off.
you.
Michael, I just want to talk a little bit about, what you write about. So I have some questions for you, and I just want to open it up with a statement question, statement slash question. Language today is an essential, if not key, component of psychological warfare and the construction of conflated logics. We see this strategically utilized within the nonprofit industrial complex. Michael, can you attempt to convey to our listeners today why it is critical to analyze language? And what I mean by that is if you could attempt to convey how language plays a vital, if not key role, in manipulating both the message and the meaning. As well, if you could touch upon how a listener today, someone listening to the show, can teach themselves to deconstruct language in order to understand the intent behind the manufactured movements that we witness dominating civil societies today. And Michael, you have the floor. I know you're very articulate, so take your time. And again, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going to try. It's difficult. This is the very nature of conflated logics, but I'm going to try. And I guess the best place to start is my current obsession, which is the term clean energy. I describe it as a mask or a temporary mask that any pundit can use to hide a set of ideas that they would rather not unpack in the public sphere. And the term clean energy in particular is one that masks a lot of destructive fossil fuel extraction that the public don't get to have a conversation about or reconcile themselves with or unpack for themselves. So how do I use clean energy as an example? There was a recent meeting of a clean energy ministerial. That's a process that is supported by the International Energy Agency. It's been going for a long time, has a lot of energy ministers and secretaries from around the world engaged in meetings. And it has various forums and processes. And inside the clean energy ministerial is a process called the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum. Now, the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum has been meeting for several years. I have found photos of the former Australian energy minister sitting there. And he's currently working in carbon capture and storage now. That process led up to a recent meeting before the Clean Energy Ministerial 8 in China. And at that meeting were the energy ministers for Canada, Australia, Norway, Japan, China, and the US, along with the IEA Executive Director, Fatih Birol. And that high-level meeting was where these leaders came out and said, carbon capture, utilization and storage is a climate solution that we want to get behind. And I guess what you can see is that under the banner of clean energy has been pushed forward a solution to sustaining consumption over time. Can you see the point that I'm making there, how one word has been used to imply that a process is going to deliver something that people want, something that is quote unquote clean, and what is delivered is more sustained destruction.
Yes, absolutely. Guy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I fell for this trick too. When I established a homestead in New Mexico, the so-called mud hut, I put solar panels up there. It was 2007, 2008, and I hadn't thought very deeply about where solar panels come from, and I was mostly interested in persisting long into the future. So, and I consider myself a relatively thoughtful, thinking kind of person, so it's easy to imagine that with so many people becoming so dependent upon electricity that we think that it's absolutely necessary for our lives. And so everybody wants to believe that we can have clean energy. After all, that sounds so much better than what we usually get, which obviously is fossil fuel-based dirty energy. And so most people, including me for a long time, didn't really recognize that there's no such thing as clean energy, that those solar panels are coming from somewhere, that something's got to be dug out of the earth, that people have to be exploited, that the whole system is dependent upon the horrors of extraction and exploitation. So, yeah. You know, it's awful, like almost everything else.
I'm a sucker too. I have the photovoltaic solar, probably one of the first residential systems in the entire city. Tied into the grid that allows all my neighbors to come out and use the most idiotic things ever invented, the stupid leaf blower. So I'm really, really happy that I participated in the further exploitation of nature and digging up, you know, God knows what, to produce these panels that enables us to waste even more on foolishness than we did prior to that. It's just crazy. But yeah, back in the day, I mean, I got sucked into that as well, thinking I was doing a really, really, you know, good thing. Michael, I mean, I'm just fascinated by your work, and I think you're brilliant in your depth of understanding how these movements work. Like, what happens? Can you tell our listeners what happens when you confront these things that are falsehoods, lies, and what kind of responses you get from leaders? Like, I don't know, Bill McKibben, 350, Klein, Carbon Tracker, like all the NGOs at the helm who are, pushing this agenda on behalf of the elites forward, you know, the business as usual agenda.
Not a lot happens. I get pat explanations, brief kind of claims that, carbon capture and storage is a boondoggle, or it's not viable, or stuff
like
that.
But I mean, what do you think about the fact we actually, okay, in a second we have a caller. What do you think about the fact we don't even hear anything about carbon capture storage? You know, the veneers, like these, the beautiful imagery of the turbines, you know, with the beautiful natural landscape in the background, and solar with children running with the sun, you know, blowing their hair, and you know we have all this beautiful imagery of things that we want to pretend are clean, but we're not even hearing really the push for clean energy is the carbon capture storage, which means continue burning as usual and, you know, bury it like the uranium, like nuclear. The push is also nuclear. I mean, how much of the sell for the, what are they calling it, the new economy is based on fantasy, would you say? Like storytelling, well, right? I mean, that's what they call it now, storytelling.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. Look, this is why I call my blog We Suspect Silence. There's a whole lot of silence around these issues. And when they do, when pundits or spokespeople or what have you do speak to these issues, they don't give a lot of time to unpacking what is really going on. So I guess for me, silence is important, is as important as certain terms behind which ideas that would sound really ugly if they were unpacked are hiding. So, what was the second part of your question?
I don't know. Just basically about how language plays a vital, if not key, role in the manipulation of the message and the meaning. And then I asked you basically how we learn to deconstruct. I mean, why is it that, and Guy, you can answer this too with some thoughts, why is it that every single campaign that's, dangled like carrots in front of basically the liberal populace, people just pounce on it. I mean, they're not interested where it came from, what foundation incubated it, what the, you know, what basically the end game is, what they're pursuing, you know, why elites would want to, you know, invest billions of dollars into having the population mobilized in a particular way. I mean, what does that say about us that we actually don't want to really know? And that's a question for either of you.
Go ahead, Michael.
There's just so much to that question.
Everything, really.
What do you think, Guy?
Well, you know, there's a reason these people became uber wealthy. There's a reason that there are five people now who have the same amount of monetary wealth as half of the people in the world. And it's because those people are tapped into information. It's because they're unbelievably skilled at manipulating a system to their own benefit. It's because of a variety of reasons, including their intelligence, their lack of empathy, their ability to exploit people without feeling a thing. I mean, there's so many things going on here, and so that's why we got the green economy, which transformed into the new economy, which are just phrases to replace business as usual to make us feel good. Green economy, what could be better than that? New economy, that sounds like I want to be involved in that. It's new, after all. So, it's the same old. It's the money going from the poor to the rich, and the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer and the middle class slipping away, all at the expense of the climate, the planet, you know, at the expense of 200 species driven to extinction every day, and the list just goes on and on. Michael, stop me.
It's really super interesting because Jeremy Hyman's co-founder of Avaaz, co-founder and CEO of the Avaaz for-profit PR firm Purpose, basically, you know, he nailed it years ago. When I think 2012, basically, we have to kill the green economy in order to save it. And so now we sell things without actually saying what we're selling. And believe it or not, people are buying it. The whole new economy, you ask anyone, and everyone's so excited. You know, you've got millions of people and you've got the population demanding to the UN, the new economy, blah, 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 the next system, you know, whatever name you want to apply to it. And yet they never really say what the new economy is, like what the new economy actually consists of. So it's quite amazing, you know. It's fairly genius. And then the whole sustainable development goals that we see now, the whole world pushing forward that agenda. I mean, that's completely all about the financialization of nature on a global scale. You know, that's the corporations as the new stewards of nature. And no one even knows, like Michael, maybe you can talk about that. I mean, that's something no one is talking about and no one is aware of. And yet behind closed doors, that is just massive. Mm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. All right. Well, what is amazing is that my blog post, The Bankers at the Helm of the Natural Capital Sector, didn't set the world on fire. The fact that, you know, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, a Goldman and Sachs man, Hank Paulson, the guy responsible for the 2008 bailout bill, is one of the leading lights in the international conservation sector, that people can't see that immediately that there may be a connection to financialization, the application of financial instruments to nature, is amazing to me. You know what I mean? It's constantly shocking that there are a whole range of bankers and through only a couple of degrees of separation are our climate justice heroes that we're supposed to never challenge, you know?
Right. As they continue trotting out the dominant narrative that we can always have more at no cost, right? So, let's take the call from Benji, and then I have another question for you, Michael, about your own personal history. Like, why should we listen to you anyway? But first, Benji, are you still with us? Benji from Berkeley?
Hey there. You know, there's no meaning to life I can see except as we choose it to be. So whatever you do might have meaning for you, but it doesn't mean jack shit to me.
Yay! I love it when Benji from Berkeley calls in. So, Michael, can you tell us a little bit about your personal history? I know you have an extensive background, written background. You have churned out an amazing amount of work. And how did you get to that point? What are your so-called credentials that allow you to come up with the insights that you keep coming up with?
I have I guess what you'd call in the U.S. a liberal arts degree, and some experience as a youth worker working with disadvantaged young people. My degree was in anthropology, and all I ever wanted to be was a youth worker working at operational level, and kind of, I guess, my bad attitude caused me to self-sabotage, and I've been self-sabotaging my way into something more real ever since, I guess. And the non-profit industrial complex kind of encroached on the sector that I was working in and kind of rendered me unsuitable. And I've spent a decade just trying to reconcile myself with the reality that I live in and the level of privilege that I have. And I met Corey along the way, and my local activism has kind of driven my writing and stuff. I have to say that along the way, I became a anti-coal seam gas mining activist, and did some interesting things in that area, and watched a awful mega coal seam gas field appear just an hour's drive from where I live, and then that kind of turned into activism against the Galilee Basin coal complex. And so I found myself kind of, you know, a stranger amongst a growing resistance against the mine, because I look at it a different way. And so right now I'm trying to do everything I can to tell people about what Jay Tarbor says, which is, if you want to stop fossil fuel export, you've got to stop the means of export. So I'm trying to tell people about this rail line, which is being played out in the same way that the Keystone XL pipeline campaign was rolled out in the US. Similar conflated logics, similar incubation of groups and control of the narrative and the messaging between a bunch of rich benefactors to a bunch of incubated NGOs and what have you.
And that's a tough message to sell. Are you in Brisbane?
Yes.
And so, Corey, I don't know if you caught that pronunciation of Brisbane.
Thanks, Guy.
Shut up, Professor.
I was going to say something.
Fuck off.
You were going to say something, but you were more polite than I was. So thanks for that.
I can't know everything about everything. I'm just going to talk to the audience for a sec. As always, we are taking your calls. Anything that avoids me listening to Guy McPherson, please dial us toll free at 888-874-4888. And if you have a message for, or not a message, well, maybe you do have a message for Guy McPherson. if you have a question for Guy or for Michael, please call in, or just call in and say hello. Michael, I'm just going to continue cutting Guy off. I think you're very, very modest. You have such a grasp on the things that I've been writing about for such a long time now. I don't think there's anybody that understands the financialization of nature that's happening now. Not very many people would understand that as well as you do. And definitely, I'm not sure if there's anyone that's following the carbon capture storage as you are. Could you tell our audience a little bit more about Carbon Tracker, first about the language that they use that came to dominate the climate movement and what that allowed for? And if you could talk about the proposed amount of carbon capture storage plants intended by the year 2050 and how you found that out.
And let's back up a little bit and describe for our audience what carbon capture and storage is at a really fundamental level.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Okay. Predominantly, carbon capture and storage is scrubbing the CO2 out of what would normally be pumped into the atmosphere from coal plants. The other most popular option is refining natural gas and tar sands oil, for instance, in refineries and putting that CO2 into what they call geological storage. So geological storage isn't something we've had a public conversation about ever, and there are various conventions that apply to it, but we just haven't had that conversation. So it's a massive, massive, insane gamble on the future, and it's being offered as a climate solution. Yeah.
Can you talk about the language initially? Like at their inception, basically, what was it? Carbon bubble, stranded assets, carbon budget, which basically got the whole ball rolling. Go ahead.
Okay. So terms like carbon budget and carbon bubble help, through their usage and repetition, help train us into thinking in terms of finite amounts. The logic that underlies the idea of a carbon bubble is that how does it work? There's a finite amount that we're going to pump into the atmosphere, and also there's an assumption that carbon capture and storage is in fact a boondoggle or whatever, and it's 20 years before we're going to be able to do anything with it or what have you, and that with that in mind, our only solution is to cut back on our coal usage. This is where it's diabolical, and explaining these logics becomes so difficult, and I can completely understand why people give up. Carbon Tracker, the people involved have been working on the edges of energy systems and carbon capture and storage, and they endorse certain ideas like deep carbonization, which I can explain shortly. Probably a very telling thing is that a man called Ben Caldicott, who's blocked me on Twitter, contributed a piece to a publication called Carbon Capture and Storage, A Last Chance for Coal. So, you know, I don't think he's ever published something to say that he's changed his position. But I believe that he blocked me on Twitter because I pointed out his real agenda. And anyway, I use him as an example of the sort of agenda that they don't speak to that's hidden behind this language of budgets and bubbles that seems to be training people into feeling that they've deduced for themselves the perfect pragmatic position to move forward with. Yeah, it's very difficult to explain, and the public narrative is contingent. Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, if I have a budget, then basically that assumes I have money to spend, right? Like a budget basically means, okay, here's what I have to work with in this amount of time, blah, blah. We all know what a budget is. If you have $10, here's what you can do in your budget. Well, obviously we have no budget. I mean, Guy, do you want to speak to that? I mean, the whole idea of a budget that language alone frames the whole global economy as we can continue.
Absolutely. And we can't continue. And we've been in the position of can't continue for a very long time. So what's the best way to deal with the fact that our budget is in deficit? Well, if you're the federal government of the United States, you get the Federal Reserve Bank to print more fake money. And if you're in the carbon burning business, you convince people that we have a budget. So you can't print money, you can't print oil, so you claim that we can keep burning oil and keep burning coal and keep burning natural gas. So it's absurd to even conclude that at any point we had a budget, but it sure is nice sounding, isn't it? It sounds like we can just keep going. We can burn another 142, whatever the number is. We can just keep going. Keep going.
We can make more room in the budget by burying carbon dioxide under the ground.
Right. There you go. We do have a caller, Susan from North Carolina. Are you still with us?
I am. Good afternoon or evening or morning, wherever you happen to be.
It's all the above. What do you guys
think?
I just wanted to call and congratulate Corey. Your pronunciation of fuck off was absolutely perfect.
That's one thing I say very well.
To add to the language discussion that, in my not-so-humble opinion, sustainable development is an oxymoron.
Yes.
And I think
I think that
if we reframe our discussion in terms of deconstructing industrial civilization rather than collapse, it might not spook the herd so badly.
I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what this is all about, is not spooking the herd.
Yeah.
And I'm reluctant to say that, given that you're part of this grand female conspiracy out to... to correct my pronunciation, but whatever.
Susan, you're absolutely right. I mean, the global goals, the sustainable development goals right now with the United Nations, that's pushing the whole financialization of nature, which is basically the key pillar of three of the so-called new economy. And so, you know, this whole carrot that they're after as the whole global economy, you know, continues close to stall speed, where it's just sort of teetering here on the brink. And this assigning monetary value, payments for ecosystem services, I mean, that whole thing is under the guise of sustainable development goals and the eradication of poverty. So, I mean, whenever you hear that, that is just, you know, a lot of language, conflated logics, the manipulation of the message, and all those things that we're actually talking about on today's show. So thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, the eradication of poverty has nothing to do with eradicating poverty and everything to do with eradicating poor people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well said.
Okay, thank you very much for your work. I'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Michael, could you talk a little bit about deep carbonization?
Yes, okay. So deep decarbonization is one of the position points of the Climate Works Foundation, and it goes hand in hand with clean energy. Deep decarbonization is basically what is planned to deliver all of the renewables that are going to save the world, apparently. It's a nice term for installing carbon capture and storage at small and large scales across various types of industry. For example, aluminium smelting, gas refining, that sort of thing. So you have examples of deep decarbonization industrial clusters being developed. Teesside Collective in the UK wants to have a pipeline to the North Sea, and no doubt that CO2 that they want to pump under the North Sea is likely to be utilized for enhanced oil recovery, which is when they use CO2 to plump up the oil to pump it out and draw it off the edges of the sticky edges of the cavities where the oil should stay forever. This is also very popular in the US. So deep decarbonization has lots of CO2 to contribute to various industrial applications. Basically, just like in the US, the North Sea is going to be another source of revenue. You know, there are cities like Hamburg have put themselves forward as a CO2 export hub from Europe, so that Europe, the continental Europe, can develop its deep decarbonization revolution or what have you. The most important thing is that language is used by the Climate Works Foundation under John Podesta with various groups. People you might have met, Corey, in Copenhagen have been giving presentations for over a decade about their willingness to be involved in deep decarbonisation. A couple of years ago, Emma Pinchbeck from WWF UK was drinking champagne with the people from the Teesside Collective, and people from Faux Scotland, Friends of the Earth Scotland, were endorsing a CO2 pipeline into the North Sea. So, yeah, I hope I've explained enough of it. I haven't explained enough about the term and how deep decarbonisation and how many pundits and mouthpieces have endorsed it without unpacking what it really means, so that the people that they're speaking to can't see the ugliness of the idea.
Wow. And before I forget, because I think I've brought this up a couple of times trying to lure you into this sort of trap, I want you to talk about the amount of, what are they called, like the industrial, I can't think of the name, Michael, the factories, the processing plants by 2050. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, okay.
Yes, I think there was something like 1,300 planned by 2050. Interestingly, when I had a conversation on YouTube with Anthony Hobley from Carbon Tracker, his explainer for the various barbs that I was throwing at him was that they adhere to the IEA Scenario 3, which I believe might also be known as 450 scenario. So it's the 2-degree scenario. It's I mean, from what I've been able to gather, and
climate negotiations. Guy, do you know the IPCC, the different scenarios that they have? You know what Michael's talking about, right?
Yeah, generally, like the RCP 8.5, like, and so on.
Is that what you're talking about, Michael?
Yes, there's a 2-degree scenario that the IEA manage the modeling and deliver to the IPCC, and that scenario necessitates a certain percentage. I think it's minimum 15% carbon capture and storage. 15% of the entire entire energy generation on the planet would come from carbon capture and storage by 2050. yeah, but this is the modeling that's reflected in slides from Al Gore's 2006 Inconvenient Truth. These are assumptions that many NGOs have had for a long time, and nobody chooses to unpack them. They certainly don't unpack them for the people. So the people don't know just what incredible scenarios they're actually buying into.
Right. And the two-degree myth continues to be promulgated by the likes of Michael Mann, for example, when he knows better. It was Corey who pointed out to me years ago that the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases accepted 1 degree Celsius above the 1750 baseline as the absolute upper limit. And, you know, that was an upper limit target established in October of 1990. And here we are still talking about 2 degrees as if it's safe. According to a legal brief filed by James Hansen in 2015, about this time of the year, there have been humans on the planet, our species, Homo sapiens, up to about 2 degrees above the 1750 baseline. And that's supposed to be safe? This is absolutely ridiculous.
And this is what a lot of mouthpieces don't have to attend to, and they're not held to this. And what I do a lot of is trying to prick people like Bill McKibben into actually, you know, challenging these unpacked concepts that seem so convenient to just leave alone.
We do have a caller. I think we have time for one more call. Hugh from California, are still with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you. However, I'll make this very quick. You may have addressed this in the past, but I came across this presentation on YouTube by Mr. David Dilley, who makes the claim and gave an extensively graphically presented with facts and his claims that climate warming occurs in natural cycles, has been occurring in natural cycles, and that he cites at least since 500,000 years ago, of which some were worse than this period, but all collapsed into a global cooling and then went back up to a global warming, of which this present one is really a natural phenomenon, number one. And then he showed a graph, a very detailed graph, claiming that the CO2 rise always came after the temperature rise, and with the claim that, well, how could CO2 be responsible for the temperature rise since it comes afterwards, perhaps as a result of the temperature rise, and basically attacking the global warming, anthropogenic global warming, and but although he says we're at the peak of the current cycle, which will start downturning. And anyhow, I was wondering if you had heard of this or heard of this guy, and if you had any commentary on it.
Sure, I hear about this sort of thing all the time. There are two glaring pieces of misinformation. One, carbon dioxide does not follow temperature rise. And two, there has never been a higher temperature with humans present, with our species, Homo sapiens present, higher than about 15.5 degrees global average temperature. That's 15.5 degrees Celsius, about 2 degrees above the 1750 baseline. So there's absolutely no evidence to support the notion that humans have been around at really high temperature and then very low temperature, and that the high temperatures automatically lead to an ice age and so on. There's no evidence to support that, but you can go on YouTube and say anything you want. And for the most part, people believe what they want to believe.
It was more than just a, sort of a rant. It was an hour-long presentation with extensive graphs and charts and claims. Also, the claims also attacking your claims to the extent that the figures have been fudged. I mean, I'm just repeating what he said on that presentation. But so basically, you're saying that the major thing about CO2 following global warming is not true.
That's correct. If you go on Vimeo and look for a presentation I did in Wyoming, I suspect you can put my name in Wyoming at Vimeo. Mm-hmm.
I've seen quite a few of your presentations.
And there's a 20-minute presentation in which I point out the actual evidence behind anthropogenic climate change. So we do have another call. We have time for a quick call from Juan.
Thank you.
From Juan in New York City. Thank you, Hugh. Juan in New York City, you still there? We've got time for a quick question.
Juan?
Living here in New York City, I see what is happening to the ecology, and I represent the blue-collar community. There are great possibilities available to us, and they're urgently needed. My brother is a very important musician here in New York City, and by putting together a coalition of the artistic community, blue-collar community, your community, the intellectual neuroscientists, we can possibly begin the process of injecting a little hope just to diminish the level of suffering that is taking place out here. There is a very crushing level of homelessness that is taking place here in New York City. People are sleeping all over the city and the street of women and children. So I would appreciate if you would put me in contact with somebody here in New York that would be interested in working to put together a coalition of the artistic community, the blue-collar community, scientists and all that, to simply diminish the level of desperation that is taking place out here. I am retired, and I committed to this, and this is something that is urgently needed. The women, the children are asking, where are the adults? Why do they allow so much pain to take place? Why don't they do something? And there is an urgent need, again, to put together a coalition to diminish the level of suffering that is taking place out here. So please take my name and number and put me in contact with someone here in New York City that can help me get the ball rolling to put together a coalition. I have perfect credit. I don't have a criminal record. I have a house in a state in Virginia, and I'm aware that there are two lots that are being sold at $10,000 a piece that I'm willing to buy so we can start a housing program, anything. And we have very important connections with the artistic community here in New York City. As a matter of fact.
Juan, what's the name of your coalition that you're starting or your collective?
I don't have a name. But just
Yet? Okay. Yeah. You know what? You're our type of caller, man. I mean, that's amazing. You're actually doing tangible things that are real, and all the power to you, and we'll help whatever way we can. So please, yeah, send in your information. We'll do what we can for you, buddy, and good luck with it. And those are huge problems.
Send me an email message, Hugh, and you can find all my contact information at guymcpherson.com. Just send me an email message. We'll get this conversation started. My email address is guy.r.mcpherson@gmail.com. And we're running out of time. I would love to continue this conversation, but time constraints have us
terminating
this enlightening conversation. So can you wrap for us? Thanks very much for spending your time with us today, Michael Swift. And
that's
Corey,
okay.
Can you go on home?
I'm going to cut you off again, Guy. Okay, Michael, thank you so much. And thanks for that call as well, Juan. That was just fantastic. Thank you, too, to our listeners and callers today. We'll see you on the radio the first Tuesday afternoon of each month at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. That means our next show will broadcast live on Tuesday afternoon, the 5th of September. If you miss us live, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm or at Stitcher and rate us on iTunes. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on prn.fm. Feel free to post questions you would like us to address on the show. And please share widely the link and information from this show. Also continue to follow the Nature Bats Last blog, guymcpherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. Thanks again to our listeners and Afrizen for his music. Thanks again to our tech guys here at CHRW and PRN. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. My
swell.